Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
Oh, thank you, Ed. Welcome to the show. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today we are listening back to two thought-provoking shows. One about the ethics around so-called designer babies or polygenic screening. And coming up a little later, a conversation about a growing religious gender divide among Gen Z. More men are attending church while young women are leaving it in droves.
First, we dig into that new technology that offers would-be parents the ability to make better babies. Polygenic screening. Private companies claim they can screen embryos for people using IVF for all kinds of diseases and characteristics. Everything from heart disease, diabetes, cancer, schizophrenia, to traits like height, eye color, and IQ.
Of course, this technology can quickly sound like we're headed down a slippery slope to eugenics. But what about the promise of healthier children? What parent wouldn't want that? To get us started exploring this brave new frontier and the ethical issues, we turn to journalist Anna Louise Sussman, who wrote a three-part series for the New York Times on this technology and the companies who offer it.
Polygenic screening is based on advances in what's called genome-wide sequencing. You can analyze the whole human genome and say, okay, a trait that's much more complex than something located in a single gene, so something like diabetes or heart disease or certain kinds of cancer, it's many, many, could be tens, hundreds of thousands of genes that may contribute to that condition. And we're going to look through the genome and say, okay, if you have X number of these, it's associated with having a higher likelihood of having a condition. But it's essentially a probability. It's not affirmation or verification of the presence or absence of a gene. It's saying you've got, you know, more of the genes that contribute to, say, being predisposed to cancer or diabetes, or this embryo has fewer of them.
Mm. So Cherry mentioned that private companies are offering these services. Mm-hmm. And of course, that raises a bit of a red flag for me, because I wonder, first, do we have any transparency around these companies' claims? In other words, are they full of you know what?
So that's a good question. The science is TBD because it's relatively recent. Yeah. And this, along with a lot of fertility medicine, it's really hard to do randomized control trials. And technologies, this is all sorts of technologies in fertility medicine, often reach the market before they're really rigorously evaluated. It's also, I mean, human reproduction. And so in general, there's a lot of ethical concerns around, you know, setting up one set of babies with this or one set of patients with that, denying the treatment to the others. It does happen, but it's much harder to do. And in general, I've heard from a lot of fertility doctors that patients are just, and from patients themselves, I should add, that they often want to try something, even if the evidence is not there. Mm. But that's, as we were saying earlier, that's with when you're trying to just get a baby. What these screenings claim to offer is the ability to select a healthy baby. That's the actual tagline of one of the companies. And whether or not they can actually do that is still up for debate, because the genetic component of any condition is just one small factor right. in what will ultimately lead to someone developing that condition or not.
One more question, real quick, as we get ready to wrap up. The laws around this in the U.S. seem very, very minimal. Is that right?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, there are no laws against it. So it's really left for a patient to navigate and to make sense of the information they're being given by the companies. As far as I know, companies require you to have some genetic counseling, but there's also, you know, a lot of ethical questions that I think are not really addressed. For example, are you setting up a expectation of what kind of child you're going to have? What happens if the child is not what you expect? Not just medical conditions, but things like height or educational attainment, or other things that people believe they can offer this screening for in the future.
Yeah. And I think you're a mom. You did not use this screening for your daughter, even though you used IVF. As we wrap up, just your thought, the big question you think this leaves for parents making these decisions.
I was reading a quote from Elon Musk's daughter. They're now estranged. She's trans, and she had written on social media that Her gender was a commodity. She believes her father selected for her to be a boy. And then when she didn't demonstrate the trait that he selected, he became really angry, and they're now estranged. And so I feel like we need to think about what it means to pick the baby you want to have, rather than just receiving your child as a gift and wanting that parent-child relationship versus a very specific kind of child.
That was journalist Anna Louise Sussman, who most recently published a three-part series called The Embryo Question in the New York Times. She set us up perfectly to dive deeper into the ethical questions raised by these new technologies with Art Kaplan, professor of bioethics at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine. He's been writing extensively on genetics and reproductive technologies for almost four decades. Art Kaplan, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Lots of comments already, yeah. Including one from Joe in Pensauken, who says, renaming it does not make it any less like the eugenics movements of the early 20th century, which quickly degenerated into overt racism, especially in the current white supremacist culture we find ourselves living in. That's Joe's take. Art, what is your take? What do you see as the major ethical questions raised by this technology?
Well, first, Avi, you have to understand this area has had no legislation, no oversight, and no regulation since it began with the birth of Louise Brown way back in 1979. Yep. And I'll age myself by saying I wrote the first article on the ethics of IVF then. But because this has been, as Anna Louise said, reproduction, legislators don't like to get near it. They don't want to talk about embryos. They don't want to get into restricting or trying to control parenting. They don't want to raise the specter of abortion. So the first big problem is there's no oversight of what's taking place here. There's nobody regulating anything. Could I try to make a perfect baby tomorrow if I was Elon Musk? And said, look, all I'm interested in is creating a computer genius. Sure, I could do it. Second, there's no agreement on what we ought to be screening for. People generally are more comfortable with diseases. But here's a question. I'm going to throw a trade at you.
Sure.
Albinism, the genetic condition where people don't have skin pigment.
Yeah.
It's not a big issue in white America. It's a big issue in other countries. If you have an albino kid, it's considered a major disease. And in some societies, you kill the albino baby. It's considered cursed.
Wow.
We don't have consensus yet. And what are we looking for?
As you point out, a lot of this is relative to the culture you're being raised in or brought into as a child. And then there's all of these quote unquote diseases. Some people might call them disabilities. That some people would look at the exact same thing and say, that's not a disability, that's not a disease.
Yeah.
So we know, I think we kind of understand why there isn't a lot of legislation here. The question is, if we were to try to legislate it, you know, where would we try to attack this thing?
So let me give you a couple of areas. First, it might be nice to set up some notion of liability and malpractice. You say you're going to do X and you don't do X. You say you're going to give a baby that doesn't have a disease, or you're going to produce a child that has better than average athletic performance, and you don't do it, who's responsible? Who's made the error? Can you hold anybody to account, or can any company just go online, as I fear they're doing, and make all kinds of promises that they're not held accountable to, and they just take money? Secondly, what about mandatory counseling about these diseases? Let's hear the perspectives of people who are deaf. Let's hear from people who have, I don't know, autism. Let's hear from people who say, this is what it's like, and you should hear this before you decide that you want to do screening. I think counseling ought to be mandatory. It ought to be defined as broad-based before you get to try these technologies. Access, I'll ask you both a question. Is there a right to have a child? Well, you might say, yeah, there is a right because we shouldn't restrict what people do in the bedroom, although there are efforts underway to do that. But there's no entitlement. If I need a surrogate mother, if I need IVF, these procedures are not paid for or covered.
Right.
Should they be? Do we need fair access? So Trump, by the way, started out as saying he was the IVF president. I don't know if either of you ever heard him say that. And then he immediately decided, well, maybe we're not going to pay for this under Medicaid.
Right.
The first time I hear a congressman say, we got to give poor people the right to have more babies, will be the first time I hear somebody say, we got to give poor people the right to have more babies using IVF and genetic screening. It's a rich person's game right now. That's not fair. You might start down those roads. Last issue. If I say I'm a 90-year-old man and I want to have a baby, and I want it to be a better baby because I don't have a biological heir, I won't be alive to see it, but that's what I want. Any restrictions on eligibility whatsoever?
Yeah, that sort of is my question right here, because we've talked about how there's no regulatory framework here in the United States. So what are the risks of just letting the market lead this?
I think when you leave it to the market, which is what we've been doing, you have all manner of practitioners, honest people who really try to help people have kids, honestly try to help them avoid diseases they know are running in their family that are primarily genetic. And then you have every private equity investor out there who says, freeze your eggs, make a better baby, go for perfection, way before the science is there. And that's my opinion of where we are now. The science, even with polygenic abilities, to start to screen for many different risk factors. It's not great science yet, but the market is pushing it because many people want to use it.
Yeah, the snake oil risk. Let me read this comment from Will in Westchester, who says, to a very large degree, we already select our children's genetic traits when we make the choice of who to procreate with. What do you see ethically as the difference between someone who's maybe an athlete at college saying, I would really like to marry another athlete and have an athletic kid, versus someone doing a similar thing but through, pre-implantation genetic testing, like testing for athletic prowess? Like, honestly, what is the real difference between those two things?
Well, again, before you set out to say, I'm going to produce a quarterback, as some parents have tried to do in creating NFL style athletes, be aware that that's not how genetics or environment works. You have no guarantees. You can increase the odds, and to some extent, genetic screening does that too. No guarantees. And let me add this again, I just want to say it. The future of the field is not infertility treatment, it is making better babies. That's where the business model is going. Whether we can do it accurately today, it's definitely something that I think we have to recognize. There are a lot more people who might want to make a better baby, even if they're fertile, than there are infertile people who want to use this. So it's a serious policy question. How does this society or any society want to make its kids? Another technology out there, just to freak out the listeners completely. We have an artificial womb in development. If you build an artificial womb, you can take reproduction all the way back and have it meet IVF and start to make screened embryos in better, quote unquote, environments. Who would want to make them in a woman's womb? Who knows what the heck is going on there? We'll make them in nice artificial wombs with the right nutrition, the right oxygen. The future could be, and I'm going to go further, probably will be to some extent, the scientific creation of better babies.
We have Lou from Hatfield who says any honest parent will say that they'd make a few adjustments. And so we only have a minute and a half or so in this segment before we go to the break. But I want to ask you, can you quickly tell us what some other countries have done? Because, US, we've left it open, but other countries have given this some thought.
Well, take a country like Singapore, which wants smart people for its small society that is very dependent on, if you will, intelligence. They give incentives to the parents they think are smart to have more kids. That's the model that Avi was using. They're not doing genetic screening yet, but I bet they do. Other societies, Holland and the UK, have some restrictions on who's eligible. But in general, Cherry, I don't think anybody's gotten up to the plate yet and done what should be done, which is to say, here's the list of diseases, screen for those. Here's the list of perfectionist stuff we're not sure yet.
That is NYU bioethicist Art Kaplan. He stays with us after the break as we continue our discussion on the ethics of making more perfect babies. And we'll also talk to a mom who has used this technology for her own children. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about major advances in genetic screening that allow would-be parents to screen for all sorts of diseases and even character traits like height and IQ. So is genetic screening a good idea? And where should we draw the line?
NYU bioethicist Art Kaplan has been walking us through some of the big ethical issues. And now we want to bring in a parent who has used polygenic screening. Simone Collins is a mom of four working on number five and a writer and activist. I asked her why she and her husband decided to use this new technology.
Yeah, our first preference was to determine birth order of our embryos because we plan on having a really large family and we have a lot of embryos. But my mother died very young of cancer, and I want to be able to give a couple extra years to our kids with higher cancer risks, because at this time, 2 or 3 years could mean the difference between life and death. And I don't want to doom our children to the same fate my mother faced.
Yeah, I read that for your daughter specifically, you wanted to make sure that you had low stress children, given the size of the family that you wanted. That trait kind of falls outside what many people would screen for. So why go for low stress and outside just disease and things that we've seen used by larger populations of people?
I could ask you why you would choose a non-psycho partner. I mean, when you choose the person you reproduce with, you're selecting for traits.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. When we look at things beyond just cancer risk, because you can see a lot of things, anything from gum disease to infertility, there are even polygenic scores for earning potential, though those don't show up with the embryo companies that we work with and individuals. So when we look at additional traits that we think are important to try to address, for which we don't think there are current cures yet, we look at a lot of mental performance adjacent traits like depression, brain fog, inability to deal with stress. There are many people who suffer from these things who really don't have a good cure right now. There are lots of people now who even wouldn't have kids if they felt like their risk of depression was really high. So one reason why we love the fact that some parents can look at things like depression for children is that it would mean the difference between them having children or not having children at all.
So do you have your own ethical line around this, something that you don't want to screen for? Or for you, is it just sort of, you know, open season? Like, I want to know all the information possible, and I want to make my pick with all of the information I can possibly get from company X, Y, or Z.
We're nerds about this, so the more we know, the better. But plenty of people have come up to us and said, hey, I have a disabled kid. You know, I just hate the idea that you are a proponent of this technology that will cause people to weed my children out of the gene pool. My response to that is always, well, yeah. And guess what? I'm autistic, and we could theoretically screen our children for autism and not have kids with higher risks of autism. We don't do that because we don't mind autism as a trait. We think it may have some advantages in the future, so we don't screen for that. The most important ethical line that we have actually has to do with coercion. We really hate the idea of people having their reproductive choice and options limited. And we think it's really evil for people either to be forced to use technology like this or to be forced not to use technology like this. People should have the freedom to form the families they want to have in the way they feel is best for them.
Can I switch back over to Art Kaplan now on that point? Because, you know, we have seen a lot of people in the comments bring up the specter of eugenics and the eugenics movement. But I think one potential distinction here is we're talking about the choice to use this on an individual level as opposed to a society level prescription for a sort of eugenical program. Is that a major distinction to you, Art Kaplan? And do you think ultimately we should lean in the direction of individual choice?
It is a big difference. And I've tried to point out the difference between Nazi eugenics is forced, coerced, genetic engineering by death, murder, sterilization, restrictions on marriage. And then what Simone is talking about is individual choice to do improvement. You can label it as positive eugenics if you want, but the key difference is a respect for individual choice. And I respect that difference, and I think it's morally obvious. What I would say is this. I think we should move down this path slowly. Clearly, there are disease states that everybody agrees is a disease state. And I'm not even talking about autism. I'm talking about death early at the age of 2 from some terrible genetic condition. It's very hard to say you shouldn't be allowed to not use screening for that. When you get to the perfectionism or the improvement, individual choice is important. However, here's where I would add something to Simone's point. I think you need to have counseling and full information. I like those conversations with people who have kids with disabilities. Remember, I brought up my albinism example. You know, there are four albinos that won the Nobel Prize. It may not matter much to people that you're an albino, but it may be a fact that you want to point out to someone. I'll give you one other example. In situations where mixed race couples are going to use a donor egg, they overwhelmingly choose white donors because they see being black as detrimental to the kid's prospects. Do they need some conversation about that? Would it be important to say, well, you choose based on your bias, your culture? So building in my field, informed consent, it means informed, not just preference, taste, bigotry.
And Simone, I guess my question, was there any counseling here? I know you and your husband are nerds about this. You mentioned that. And so you've done a lot of work for this. But I just wonder, was there any type of counseling there? And would you recommend that for other people who may not be as knowledgeable about this and wanted to use such services?
Yeah, I think counseling is a great idea and a very good thing for couples to get, especially because polygenic risk score selection, what we're doing is only about risks. It's not about guarantees. Now, obviously, there are some genes that can pretty much guarantee a really terrible medical condition. But what we're talking about with polygenic scores is mostly just, hey, relative to a population that also is very broadly based off of Europeans' genetics. So if you're East Asian or something else, it may not be as predictive. You know, you need to be coached through these things. And I think it's really important. I would want to add one point to Art's note that it wouldn't be necessarily bad to stop all families from having certain kids with really terrible crippling diseases that make them die at age two. I think that's tragic. I wouldn't want to do that to a child. But I will point out that there are some religions that believe destroying any embryo for any reason whatsoever, not carrying it to term and bringing it to as long of a life as it can have, is morally wrong. And again, I really believe that people should have the freedom to make whatever choice they think is morally right, even if that makes us very uncomfortable.
Well, just jumping in there, you may have a situation where they're asking the rest of us to pay for that choice. So again, when one is making individual choices, okay, you pay the freight, you carry the cost. It's a very different thing to say you're in the ICU for 2 years with an inevitable death charged to a health system that's overwhelmed.
Right. And then that the ethical considerations are sprawling in a society where we all share the risk burden and the cost, which is, you know, this is the society we live in, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And Simone, I wanted to ask you one more question. How do you have these conversations with your children? Do you tell them that they were part of this screening? Do you not tell them? Does it even matter whether or not they know?
It 100% matters. And even for our kids who don't have this kind of screening, because not all of them do, we will, when they're old enough, get them fully genomically sequenced. Why does this matter? Well, one of the most common scores that you get on these polygenic risk scores for embryos, but you can also get this for yourself as an adult or for a child, are polygenic risks for things like schizophrenia. Why does this matter? Well, if you tell one kid, hey, avoid cannabis, drugs are bad, they're going to think that you're just being a square parent. If you tell your kid, hey, listen, you're personal genetic polygenetic risk for developing schizophrenia is higher than the average for the population, and high doses of cannabis can trigger schizophrenia. So while it's fine that your friend Jimmy has as much like cannabis vapes as he wants, you really shouldn't, because you could go crazy. It's really good to tell people that. So yes, we tell them that they're screened. We tell them what their risks are, because in some cases, we're going to want them to get screened for certain cancers really young. In other cases, we want them to avoid certain foods or risk factors. So this stuff is really valuable, not just in terms of choosing birth order or embryos.
Yeah. So you see it as a form of empowerment and knowledge. Really interesting.
Absolutely.
So Art, let me ask you one more question as we start to wrap up. I do wonder a little bit, like, this is all fascinating conversation when we talk about where this technology is headed. But when we started this conversation, I noted, we noted that for the most part, this is used to screen for, like, you know, disease factors with a single genetic input. It's not used in this polygenic way, or it's used for fertility reasons. Is this conversation a bit of a red herring to be talking about this, to be highlighting this, when a lot of people just want access to the use that is the most common? Because I do think some people worry that we're demonizing this technology a bit.
Yeah, Well, that's a fair point. I think we do have a public policy question in front of us. Should we or should we not cover infertility services for all? That depends on your answer to the question, is there a right to have a child? And I think there is. And I think it's an important aspect of life if you choose and want to do that. So that is today's problem. Tomorrow's quickly going to emerge, however, because while I'm not convinced yet that the science is strong, we're not really that great at predicting complex behavioral and mental traits. We just aren't. But we will be. We'll get better. And the time to discuss how to apply that is now. You don't want to do it in the middle of a gigantic corporate marketing scheme to say everybody ought to buy this and create two classes of people, the people who can do fancy improvement, the people who can't. And you don't want to wind up either making sure you've got to have a safety net for people who don't choose it. Disability won't go away. There still will be outcomes that are poor. You got to protect the rights of those people too.
That was New York University bioethicist Art Kaplan and Simone Collins, a local mother, writer, and activist. Coming up after the break, we're shifting gears to religion. There are some interesting new trends among Gen Zers. More women are leaving religion while more men are attending church. We're going to talk about what's behind this shift right after a short break, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Studio Two.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio Two. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. There's a growing Gen Z gender divide in the pews. While young Christian men are sticking with religion, young women are leaving the church in droves. For the first time, men appear to be more religious than women, with higher church attendance.
These Zoomer trends come at a time when religiosity in America is finally stabilizing. After decades of declining religious affiliation, the number of people who identify as nuns or religiously unaffiliated has finally plateaued.
So, are Zoomer men starting a religious revival? Why are young women leaving organized religion? And what does this gender drift mean for our culture and politics?
We pose those very big questions to Melissa Deckman, the CEO of PRRI, the Public Religion Research Institute. She's also the author of The Politics of Generation Z, How the Youngest Voters Will Shape Our Democracy.
I do think that we're seeing a plateauing of people disaffiliating from religion. And what's been notable is that over the past 2 decades, we've seen a stark rise in Americans shedding their religious labels. We've seen certainly a slowdown. We find that about 28.2% of Americans roughly now identify as religiously unaffiliated. At the same time, I think that we're seeing fewer Americans shedding the Christian label. But again, it's important to recognize that there is still, I think, somewhat of a longer-term trend for people being more religiously unaffiliated, in part because we know that people often remain religious if their upbringing is religious, and more and more Americans don't have that religious upbringing any longer. But below that, you know, national kind of trend data, there's definitely some interesting things happening with Generation Z.
And so dig into that. Peel back the layers because we've been seeing these headlines sort of trickling up about a gender divide in this generation. Tell us about that.
So in the past decade, you know, we've been tracking religious affiliation here at PRI pretty regularly, the extent to which people go to church and pray and read their Bible or scripture. What we found is that American Gen Z women, at least, have become far more or less religious. Back in 2013, about 29% of young women identified as a religious nun. That really ballooned to 40% in our last census of American religion. So a really 11-point increase over time. At the same time, our data shows that young men have plateaued, essentially. There's been no change with respect to their religious affiliation. So we find that approximately the same number of young men, about 35% to 36% over the last decade, remain religiously unaffiliated. And so that, to me, is a very interesting religion story. One, because American women historically have always been more religious. And if you look at older generations, those, you know, women do tend to be more religious than men, but the reverse is happening when it comes to Gen Z, and that's kind of an interesting trend.
Mm. Wow. Just to clarify, when you say religious nun in this context, it's N-O-N-E, folks, not N-U-N.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
I want to bring in a caller now. This is Sarah from Robbinsville who wants to join the conversation. Hey, Sarah, you're on Studio 2. What is your question or comment or perspective here?
My comment and perspective is I'm on the younger side, not 29, I'm 39, but I've been raised in the church with my siblings, and it's just interesting how you can be raised by the same parent and all split off and do different things. I'm raising my daughter in the church. She goes to church every Sunday. She's in the choir. She goes to Sunday school. She was baptized. While I have a sibling that, you know, doesn't go to church at all, doesn't really believe in any of that stuff. And then a sibling who here and there goes to church.
Yeah, the full range in one family.
And quick question, Sarah. Right. Quick question, Sarah. Is male siblings, female siblings? Tell me the gender makeup and
so
is there a difference there?
My oldest sister is completely out of the church. And then my brother goes with his fiance here and there. But not much.
Mm. Interesting. Thank you. That's Sarah from Robbinsville. Melissa, can we sort of get into some of the whys you're seeing this gender divide? So what is driving women out and what's keeping the guys around?
Yeah, sure. So I think in my book, The Politics of Gen Z, you know, it's a story largely about gender and how gender is fueling changes among Gen Z in terms of their political behavior. But it's also, I think, extended to their religious behavior. So with Generation Z women in particular, we have what I would call sometimes a more fiercely feminist generation. So gender consciousness really matters to young women. And a lot of young women have left the church because they feel as though they don't want to be part of denominations that don't ordain women, for example. Mm. And so I think that's a factor that, you know, in their own lived experience, they're out doing things, they're embarking on careers that have been traditionally male, they're playing sports, they're becoming, you know, leaders in their own right. And so to not have that ability in a more traditionally minded church, I think is probably a bit off-putting. I think also for young women, we find in our data at PRI that they tend to identify more as LGBTQ, much more than young men. And we have found in our own analysis of young people who've left religion in America, 6 in 10 say that they leave because of the church's treatment of LGBTQ individuals or their beliefs about LGBTQ individuals.
Six in 10. And so, that's a very high mark.
6 in 10 young people have left for that reason. Other people reasons people leave is because of mental health, that the religion's been bad for their mental health. That's often a commonly cited reason there. Most people leave because they just stop believing. And then finally, I'd add, you know, at least with some more conservative churches, there has been, I think, in recent years, amplified by the manosphere, this idea of a doubling down on more traditional gender roles in churches. Mm-hmm. And so for young women, that's something that's not appealing. Mm. Now, on the other side, that might help to explain why some men, young men, are actually not leaving, right? And so some evidence suggests that the young men who are staying in churches today, at least in Christian churches, tend to actually have more conservative views on gender roles, right? And I think in a political atmosphere where you have, just look at last fall's election, right? This kind of doubling down on masculine themes. You know, there's a sense for at least some young men that they feel like they're not valued because of who they are as men. And so into that space, I think you have some conservative churches making appeals to younger men and really kind of, again, talking about the importance of what in religious terms would be the male headship role, that men are protectors and that, you know, you don't have to apologize for being a man. This is what we do here in this church. And so I think at least for some young men, that might be appealing and might be a clue as to why not disaffiliating, right?
Yeah. Yes, sir. Maybe some sort of equal and opposite reaction phenomenon happening here. Although, as you point out, it's not really equal right now we're seeing in terms of the data we're seeing, but something to watch. Let's bring in some more callers. Mm-hmm. Let's hear now from Lauren in Havertown.
Hello. I believe that young men stay or become religious because historically, religion has controlled women, and women don't want to be controlled anymore. And I believe that is part of the reason that they leave religion.
That's an interesting perspective from Lauren. Can I ask a question off of that to you, Melissa Deckman? I think we have a lot of comments along those lines. And yet what's interesting is that historically, even though that was always, as Lauren says, at least in Lauren's perspective, that was always kind of like the case, right? That men had were at the top of the hierarchy in many formalized religious structures. And yet, a lot of the participants disproportionately were women. So how do we explain that? Like, why in the past did it seem like women had a more active role, given that in many faiths, men were at the top of the hierarchical pyramid?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think historically, if you take a longer lens, in the 20th century, in fact, you know, women, I think, were really doing most of the work of the church and keeping the church kind of, you know, really functioning in a lot of ways. So men were certainly leaders, but women were staffing the altar guilds or teaching mm-hmm. Sunday school or doing the clothing and food drives, right? And I feel like disproportionately evidence shows that it's happening still today. And I think for many women who, for example, were more traditional homemakers or didn't have sort of the careers in business that you now see, like many women, of course, do today, church became sort of an acceptable outlet for them to use their resources and their skills and to organize. It was very socially acceptable, a place for them to maybe exhibit some of those leadership, you know, I think muted leadership, not preaching from the pulpit, but certainly really helping churches kind of to run on time and those sorts of things. Mm. And so I think that now with younger women, I think there's a sense that, you know, that's an unequal kind of status, and they're just not wanting to be part of that any longer. It's kind of caught up. So I think, you know, there's cultural lag, certainly. And I think still today, you know, if you go to most church services, you see it's disproportionately older people and older women who are still the lifebloods of a lot of these churches. And so I think that's an interesting thing to keep an eye on. Mm.
And by the way, we're going to bring in a perspective from a local church. But first, I want to bring in a caller. We have Marcy from Morrisville on the line. Marcy, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment or perspective on this issue?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have three Gen Zs, a 29-year-old, 25, and 22. The two older are boys. They sought out churches specifically for a sense of community that they can't find in their generation. Mm. One chose evangelical, one chose Catholic, and the daughter, who's 22, is an atheist.
Wow.
The two boys are loving the sense of community and have really embraced the different religions. They were all raised Christian, but I let them do what they needed to do. But specifically, all I hear from the Gen Zers are there's no sense of community. There's nowhere to go to find people who are like us and who want to do what we do. So they've found that in their churches.
Wow. Mm.
And so just to drill down a little bit, Marcy, when you say your sons felt like they couldn't find community anywhere, is that a sense of like social isolation, being online too much? Like, what do you think was, why couldn't they find community in other places? Have they ever like sort of told you that or expounded on it at all?
Yeah, we talked about it very openly. Yeah, it was, of course, during COVID when the social isolation was at its worst. But they've found that they're very interesting. They want to do different things, and they're not about going to bars and meeting people and drinking. So they wanted something different that was a lot more fulfilling. And I said, why don't you just go to a church and join a young adult group and, you know, see if you can find people that are like you? And they did. And that's what they've been doing. And I have to say, both are really enjoying it.
That's so interesting.
And quick follow up about your daughter who has left the church. Any reason why? Was it what we were talking about here?
Yeah. Speaker, yeah, she was on point. She said, you know, I don't like how they treat women. Women are not really sort of brought up to any kind of leadership role, and I don't like the whole feeling. Yeah, it was everything she said that your speaker said. It was right on point.
Well, Marcy, what a call. Marcy from Morrisville, just telling the whole story of the show in 90 seconds.
With her kids. Her kids are the example.
Thank you so much, Marcy. And we want to talk about, you know, what people on the ground are feeling and seeing. Do they see more young men joining churches, as Marcy was talking about there? So with us now to discuss all of that is Brad Leach, the founder and lead pastor at City Life Church in South Philadelphia. Hey, Brad, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Brad, tell us a little bit about your church and what you're seeing as far as like who's coming in with this Gen Z.
Yeah, so our church is 13 years old. We started it in high school in the Italian Market area of South Philly until we moved into a permanent facility. But Part of that story is that, for 7 years of our church, we had no building outside of the school that we were renting on Sundays. And so we were really forced out of necessity to use homes and coffee shops and restaurants and parks in order to gather people. And as a result, community and creating just simple onboards for people to enter into relationships with one another has been a big part of the story of our church. I really resonate with Marcy, this last caller, in terms of what we have seen in our church. It is people who I think have experienced a lot of the isolation. There's an epidemic of loneliness among young men right now, who are looking for a male role model. When you reverse engineer, I think a lot of the symptoms of what we're seeing the young men are experiencing today in our country, a lot of it goes back down to the loss of a male role model. And so in a church that has multi-generational diversity, that has multi-ethnic diversity like ours, a young man can come in, can find somebody who's 10, 20, 30, even 40 years older than they are, who can become a guide for them to move through the stages of a man's life. And we're seeing, just anecdotally in our church, we're seeing a rise among Gen Z coming into our church in both young men and young women. But a lot of them, it's interesting, will attend one of our small groups before they'll even attend a service on Sunday.
And what does that tell you, the fact that that's the entree for a lot of younger people into like your congregation?
Yeah, I think again to what Marcy was just saying in regard to her own kids, there is a longing to belong. Where can a young man today say, I'm depressed, I'm lonely, I'm experiencing panic attacks? Where is the group where that guy can open up about those things that maybe would not fit into what our culture would say is masculinity? And so, providing a group where it's safe to open up about the real struggles that all of us are experiencing, I think is meeting a need that a lot of people have.
Thank you so much for that perspective. That's Brad Leach, founder and lead pastor of City Life Church in South Philly. Brad, really appreciate the time
Thank
today.
you. Yes. Want to read a couple comments,
Yeah, so
Avi?
we've got a lot of people here lined up. So here's a comment from Jim on YouTube. The bros are clinging to any semblance of superiority they can find. Trump bragged about taking care of the women. True religiosity fades as one ages. E mentions it's all Putnam bowling alone. So that's a sociologist, Robert Putnam, talks about the idea that people are spending less time in groups, and obviously religion can fill that void for many people.
And I want to read this comment from Maura, who says, I grew up Irish Catholic and could never get into all the fire and brimstone. So I spent my teens and 20s trying all different religions, Buddhism, Judaism, you name it. Turns out having faith in myself is all the religion I need. So Maura is one of the young women who have left the church.
I want to reintroduce Melissa Deckman here, who's been with us the whole hour. Melissa's the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. We haven't really touched on, Melissa, what types of religious organizations, what sects are seeing growth and which are still seeing steep decline. Because we can look at the big picture and say, well, there's this overall plateau, but that doesn't mean everyone's feeling this or experiencing this equally. Can you take us inside the numbers a little bit there, Melissa?
Yeah, sure thing. I would say the trends I'm seeing when it comes to the more formal organized denominations, whether it's the ECLA, in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, or even the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the largest conservative evangelical Protestant denomination, you see their memberships declining, right? And I think that that's part of a larger trend where many Americans are just growing skeptical of institutions more broadly. But I do think there's some growth when it comes to mega churches and more non-denominational grassroots, kind of authentic churches there, kind of Brad, the pastor from the other church. There does seem to be anecdotal evidence of some growth in those kinds of areas. I do want to kind of circle back to a point that was raised from Brad and from some others, in that, I do think that Americans are hungering for a sense of community. We find in our data at PRI that among Americans who attend church regularly, 80% say they do it because they want to experience a community of believers, right? So there's personal beliefs, right? But there's also a power in being with like-minded folks here. And I also would just echo the last caller. Just let me say this. There is a huge religious diversity in this country. I think a lot of people, when they think about religion, the loudest voices that are often televised as being religious might be conservative, I think, and evangelical. But in reality, you run the gamut from Unitarians to the Episcopal Church to Jewish Americans to others. And there's really no monolithic attitudes when it comes to things like LGBTQ equality or reproductive rights or the role of women as leaders and the role of queer folks in church leadership and being ordained. So I think that's a really important point to bear in mind, that people sometimes have this perception, this kind of mono church idea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And our data really increasingly always show that there's so much diversity when it comes to the religious landscape.
Yeah, and I want to read this comment from Carla, who says, I'm a 60-year-old Black woman who grew up in a predominantly white evangelical church. I stopped going to church as I see too much hypocrisy in members' political views and support of Trump MAGA. But I have three sons, ages 26, 25, and 21, and I find that they are more interested in reading their Bibles and seek community at church. They enjoy church, and I think they find emotional support.
Oh, fascinating.
And I wanted to sort of like expand on and go back to the idea of this gender gap. Do you think this is a blip on the screen, or do you think this is something, a trend that will actually continue? And then the impact it could possibly have on dating and marriage and birth rates, if you're talking about a gender divide with this young generation that's coming up.
Yeah, no, I think this is something we should really keep a closer watch of. I mean, we're seeing this larger gender divergence among Generation Z when it comes not just to religion, but also to politics, to culture. I think part of it is a result of really Americans being more isolated, spending more time on their phones, right? And the algorithms often kind of propel you. If you're young women who care about social justice, you're getting fed online sources that reinforce those views. And in some ways, you're finding community, but the downside of that is that you're not hearing alternative perspectives or hanging out with people that are different than you. And of course, we see the same thing obviously happening on the right when it comes to young men who are maybe listening to Joe Rogan or other people in the manosphere, and the algorithms feed them into like-minded communities. And we're seeing this really being a lot more pervasive among younger people today. And so it can be potentially, I think, quite destabilizing. You know, a lot of younger people are delaying marriage or not getting married at all. We've seen increasingly in our society that people will choose their political partners based on their political views. That was unheard of 20 to 30 years ago.
They even put it on the apps. They put it on the apps.
I know. Yeah. Exactly. And I think that can be potentially pretty destabilizing. We already have a lot of polarization in our politics in America. But what I worry about when it comes to younger people, if you have young women siloed as very, very liberal, and my book shows that they are very progressive, more so than even older women, but very different in their views and attitudes when it comes to young men. And I think the other factor too, we haven't really talked much about it, but there's like a class issue as well. Studies are showing that women are increasingly college educated, especially younger women. Men are bowing out of college at different rates. And so, in some ways, marriage as an institution is somewhat healthy, especially if you have people that are college educated and they tend to stay longer in marriage compared to historical norms. But I think the other side is that younger people, because they have differing political views and educational values and all of these sorts of things and attitudes about gender equality, all these kinds of things together, it can have, I think, potentially a destabilizing effect in terms of future coupling. And childbearing. But there's also an economic component. I think a lot of young people don't want to have kids because it's really expensive, and younger people are struggling to get out of their parents' basement a lot of times, right?
Absolutely.
So that couples into all of this as well.
Sure. Yeah. Let me read in a couple more comments, and we do have some callers waiting. I would love to get to them as well as we get toward the end of the hour here. Yelena on YouTube says, my pastor is a lesbian. I follow a lot of female pastors on social media. They always point to the history of women in the church and in the Bible. Brosafan says, there are vibrant communities of young Jews, some of which are in Philly. It seems as if more women than men are involved. Many meet outside of traditional synagogue buildings.
Maybe we can get this last caller in. We have Justin from West Philly who's been waiting on the line. Justin, you're on Studio 2 with your question or comment and noting that we're short on time. So keep it brief.
All right. Absolutely. Thanks very much. I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church and I left in college. And I've tried other churches, house churches, nothing fit because it all kind of came back to religion. And I agree that, like, my brothers still go to the Southern Methodist Church. They're looking for some form of community social production function they don't get in society. So I'm wondering if you think that eventually, if men feel more included, people will leave the church again, because ultimately I stayed out because I just don't believe, and it always does come back to religion in some form. So I'm just curious.
That boomerang back effect. Like, if you're looking for community, but then ultimately you get down that path and you realize, hey, but I don't have sort of the dogmatic belief, you know, what happens? Any thoughts on that, Melissa?
Yeah, you know, as I alluded to earlier, we ask people why they end up leaving religion. And, you know, the number one factor for all Americans who've left, like we found in 2023, the last time we asked this, 67% said they just stopped believing in their church's teaching, right? Wow. And so I think that's an important point to consider. You know, churches are great for building social capital, for building community. But, you know, sometimes the content of the sermons or the contents of the theology might not be always welcoming to people, or maybe it doesn't kind of feed into their larger ideas and views about. Exactly. There's a lack of jiving there. And so I think that's a really important point to kind of bear in mind.
That was Melissa Deckman, the CEO of PRRI, the Public Religion Research Institute. She's also the author of The Politics of Generation Z, How the Youngest Voters Will Shape Our Democracy.
Have to say thank you to our producer. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks for joining us.